serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking 70 years since the Berlin airlift with a man who experienced it firsthand, 91-year-old John Durant. And you know, I realized that when you were sharing earlier, there were 750 incidents of Russian fighters harassing these American transport planes on their humanitarian missions. I didn't ask about your personal experience with that. So on those 147 flights that you made, anything like that ever happened to you?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, we knew they were there. You see out the windshield, they're flying right at us and peel off. Yeah, they were shining these airport lights in our eyes. They were trying to mess up the radios. They were doing everything they could to bust up, except shooting. They never shot at us. Mm-hmm. That would start the war.
And if a war started, America's recourse, because you don't have the troops and the planes built up over there, America's recourse was drop nukes.
Yep, exactly.
So if they would have engaged you guys, there probably would have been nuclear bombs dropped on Russia somewhere.
Sure.
And yeah. We might not be here anymore.
No, there's another story that goes along with that. We flew 90 B-29s over to Europe. There were 45 in Britain and 45 in Germany. There were no atom bombs on them, but nobody knew this.
They're the silver plate models configured for that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Silver plates, yeah. No, nobody knew this. Truman said, I don't want atom bombs on those things at all, but it's a big secret. I don't want some lieutenant colonel starting a war, okay? There was nobody knew this. All they knew were there were 45 B-29s in Britain and were 45 B-29s in Germany. And just the threat of them being there kept us alive.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, they had 300,000 troops within 30, 40 miles of Berlin. We had 15,000 troops in Berlin. Most of them were workers and dependents. They were going to send the dependents home. Truman said, no. They're going to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to sacrifice these people if you have to, but they're going to stay there. We don't want to give them the word that we're scared and we're going to move ourselves out. But we had an evacuation plan set up all over the place.
Well, and for you, here, you've met a wife because of your deployment in Europe. You've got her to think about. You've got...
We had a baby. We had a kid. We had a son, yeah.
So you've got a wife and a son.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the future holds.
No, I have no idea.
Was that a little nerve-wracking?
No, I tell you, we were confident that we were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
You're an American. You're going
to
win.
And what do you think contributed the most to that victory? Because the Berlin airlift was a victory for West Berlin, for America and its allies. What do you think made the difference?
Do you know the history of Germany trying to reinforce Stalingrad with air power, with air flights in there?
Sure, yeah.
They made about over 300 flights in there. And Goering said, oh, yeah, I can do this. 300 flights. We had 277,000 flights into Berlin. The power alone, okay, like Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly and carry a big stick.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big stick, and they knew it. We had all the sticks. They had nothing. So we knew we were going to win. At that point, the confidence of America in doing the right thing and winning was overwhelming. And sadly, some of that stuff is being eroded today. Some of the people that are trying to undermine our president today make me ill, make me sick. But that's another story. I don't want to get into that.
Can you believe it's been 70 years since the Berlin airlift?
No, and I tell you what happened. I was at a SERS meeting, Seniors in Retirement meeting, last Tuesday, and I'm an aviation guy. I give an aviation talk, and as I got all through, and somebody raised his hand, got a question. He says, what were you doing 70 years from today? I looked at myself, oh my God, I forgot all about it. This is the beginning of the airlift. So I talked about a half an hour about the airlift, and they really, really appreciated hearing some of this story.
Have you ever looked back and thought how different your life had been had you not joined the Army Air Corps at age 17?
I would do it all over again. What I did in Europe, and then later on in life, I had some fantastic experiences later on in life and met some fabulous people. I have a lot of friends today, fabulous people. I don't know what happened. What I wanted to be was an aeronautical engineer. My dream was to go to MIT, become an aeronautical engineer, design airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I got out, I went back and I ran back to MIT, got back in September. It was full. Oh, geez. So I wandered across the river, this Boston University. I wandered in there, and they had the setup for veterans, a big deal in the auditorium. What do you want to take? It's engineering, there's business, there's social studies as well. I want to take engineering at MIT, not here. So I want to sign for business. At that point, they didn't even ask, do you have a high school education? Are you an American? Where do you live? Are you qualified? Just sign here. I got a business degree, then I got a master's degree, and then I got 2 years of law school. And incidentally, the government paid for this. The government and company paid for this whole thing. GI Bill was the savior for many of us. We'd have never been able. I would never have been able to go to college without the GI Bill. We just weren't that affluent. It was college for rich kids, you know. We weren't rich. And then the company paid for my master's degree. And the company paid for my 2 years of law school. Mm-hmm. The way it was, the company would pay half the tuition while you were going to school, and then when you graduated, they paid the other half. I was very fortunate. So all my education was free.
And how did your path turn toward the space program?
That's a funny story. I'm working for ITT in New Jersey. What do you do Christmas? You go home to Boston. What do you do New Year's? You watch the Rose Bowl Parade, okay? You're sitting there and you see these girls in bikinis on floats, you know. You look outside and the snow is swirling up to the second story. You say to yourself, what in the heck am I doing here? So you go back Monday morning and say, what do you guys got going on in California? Well, we're starting up a project at Vandenberg. You want to go? Yeah, I want to go. So a month later, I'm at Vandenberg. That's how I got into the missile program. We're launching 3 missiles a week, and I just stayed with the missile program all my life.
What were your specific duties?
Well, mostly radar. We were a radar company, and I was involved in radar. We had 147 radar stations. This is later, all over the world. At that time, we did not have satellites, so most of it was landline and radio communication. Later on, we had satellites, so we could handle it better. First of all, we had, for the Apollo program, we had 10 Victory ships on the ocean. They were floating radar stations. There were 5 in the Atlantic and 5 in the Pacific. And these were floating radar stations because we had radio stations all over the world, but in long stretches of water, you needed to communicate with these Gemini and the Mercury and the Apollo program on a constant basis. You could have 5 minutes between stations, but you needed to know what was going on. So we had Capcoms in all these different places all over the world. We had radar stations in Woomera, Australia, Madrid, and they were accepting all these radio signals from everywhere. One of my jobs on a Christmas Eve when Jim Lovell went around the moon, the first time around the moon. We were getting the signals from them, and I was Christmas Eve. My job was to get the radio signals from radio to a hard copy on the aircraft carrier and get that back to NASA. So I was on the phone half the Christmas. I had a party at my house, and I was on the phone half the night doing the work.
Did your wife know what you were doing?
Oh, she knew. Oh, yeah. There was no secret to what I was doing. That was all out in the open. I wasn't doing secret work. I had a top secret clearance, but I wasn't doing secret work. Generally speaking, we had about 6,700 people in a radar contract for ITT. We had the contract for several years, and we were transmitting all of the information back. Once in a while, I run into these people who believe that we never went to the moon. It was all always a hoax. And I said, you know what? How do you silence 400,000 people that were involved in that effort between manufacturing and transportation and the guys on the aircraft carrier and all us guys? And we were one contractor. There were many other contractors building the spaceship, you know, building all the components for this. We tracked that thing all the way to the moon and back, and I know they were there. I know they were there.
Well, I'm glad you dispelled that conspiracy theory. Is there something you would say from all your years involved in the space program? Is there something that you're aware of that you'd say most people probably aren't aware of and probably should be?
Yeah, the communication between spacecraft. People think we launch these things and throw them up there and hope. They're navigated all the way from here to wherever they're going in space. I was at Jet Propulsion Laboratory during the time we launched Voyager 1 and 2 toward Jupiter and Saturn. In about 1970, JPL hired a PhD in electronics, I guess, out of Caltech, and put him to work at JPL. And his hobby at that time was tracking spacecraft in the sky, navigating from here to there, using the gravity of the planets as part of the motive power. When his contract was up, JPL said, why don't you just stay here and continue to do this? This was 1970. When we arrived there in 78, took over the contract for tracking Jupiter one and two to Saturn and Jupiter, we hired him and we put him in charge of the space navigation team. Well, the space navigation team was composed of about seven or eight young kids that were masters in mathematics and so forth, and they tracked the spacecraft all the way. And here's how they did it. Radio signals from the spacecraft came in. They knew from what direction, they knew where it was. They computed every night with tab runs that we had at those days. I don't know if you remember, computers those days had great big sheets of paper with ones and zeros. And
they were
this
binary
thick, you know,
code.
Yeah, binary, okay, with carbons, you know. One shift, it worked this whole thing. At the end of the shift, they wouldn't know where the spacecraft was, and they would put this, like for example, put a dot on the wall, you know. It was in 100-day increments, and the next day, next shift, you know, another dot on the wall. Pretty soon, after 75 days, these dots would all converge. They said, the spacecraft is supposed to be here, but we want it over here. So they roll it over, fire the positioning jets for like 3 minutes, change the trajectory, and start all over again. 100-day. That precision got it to Jupiter and Saturn, and we dove it down between the rings of Saturn. That's how precision that was. Now, you say, why do you need to do this? Well, out in space, you've got gravity of all those planets. The planets do not suddenly exert the same gravitational effect from every single place on the planet. There's different mineral deposits that change the gravity strength, okay? So it changes, okay? You got these things all in different trajectories, okay? You've got solar wind, which makes a big difference in the space, okay? And something that people don't know is you got to urinate in that spacecraft. You got to eject that urination. That's a spray, okay? That's a little jet. What it does, it changes to a very minute degree the trajectory of the spacecraft. So there's all these kind of things you got to take care of. People don't know this kind of stuff because nobody tells them.
So what you want people to know is they haven't considered the effect that an astronaut's urination has on the trajectory of his aircraft.
No, that's a minor item. No, that's a minor. What I want them to know is you don't throw these spacecraft up and hope they're gonna go there. You try and navigate them all the way.
There's an incredible amount of mathematical calculation that accounts for that precision.
I got to tell you another story. I did a lot of kids teaching along the way. I used to use this analogy. I said, do you guys remember when Neil Armstrong landed that spacecraft on the moon the first time? The computers went wild. 20 seconds into the flight, they said overloaded. He had to take over and land that thing by himself with controls. How do you think he knew how to do this? Because he practiced this in a simulator 300 times. Now, try to remember this tonight when you begrudgingly allocate 20 minutes for your algebra. Because when you get out in the world, it's going to be 300 times, I'll guarantee it. It's not going to be 20 minutes. Think about this for a minute and contemplate it tonight. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I'm going to make my daughters listen to this episode now, and they'll hear it in your voice. We're about out of time, but I want to make sure that I say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for giving us a little taste of your long and varied career in the service of our country. As you look back over it, now at 91, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Being a part of the space program. It's incredible. Not too many people had the privilege that I had. Not too many people had the experience. Met the people, and I met a lot of the astronauts. Some of them are my friends today. I'm the scholarship chairman of the Southern California Aero Club. We give away about $50,000 a year to kids studying aviation and aerospace. We have a banquet every September, and last year I had Kevin Gazarian, General Kevin Gazarian, as a speaker. He said, I'll come back again this year, so he's coming back. So we have an astronaut speaker. That's an exciting thing to do. And several of the astronauts are my friend. Someday we're going to go to the stars. I don't know how. They're light years away, but we'll get there. We discovered America. It was thought it was too far away. Today, things are too far away. It's hard to contemplate how we're going to get across the 4.5 light years, but we'll find a way.
And is there anything else that you'd like to say as we mark 70 years since the Berlin airlift? Is there something you'd like people to know or remember, or how they should see or view or remember that moment in history?
I think we saved the world. At that time, the Cold War was probably uppermost in most people's minds. We already found out that the Russians had finally discovered how to explode an atomic bomb and so forth. I think that the strength of our country, and I think Reagan did it, and Trump is doing it again, building up the military. We need to have a strong military because, as Teddy Roosevelt say, you got to speak softly and carry a big stick. And Trump has already accomplished this with North Korea, the big stick. I don't think that any other thing in the world would have caused that premier to capitulate the way he did, except he was afraid of the big stick. We told him, you know, you send one missile to Guam, and we're going to wipe you off the face of the earth. So again, keep strong.
Anything you want to say about your wife? And have you ever thought, hey, if Uncle Sam didn't send me to Germany, never would have met my wife?
She was the greatest thing in the world. I knew it the instant I met her. I said, you know what? This one has possibilities. And I chased the hell out of it until she agreed to marry me. Like I say, 66 years. Beautiful years, yeah. I lost her to cancer 5 years ago. I miss her terribly. We had a ball. We went all over the world. She never murmured, never objected to anything we did, went anywhere with me, did anything I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time.
Well, we've had such a good time today. I'm just sorry we're out of time. Find links to more information about the Berlin Airlift and photos of John Durant then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.